If we're talking about psychology in this context, in Berlin at this moment, we must say something about psychology as a discipline in the context of Germany in the past. The last century is still with us and lies like a nightmare on the minds of the living. We could say that the question of psychology is a question of history. Psychology was one of the first academic professions in Germany to openly embrace Nazism. This was not only because of a biological reductionist account of human activity that fitted so well with eugenics. It was also because psychology pretends to be a science of the human spirit. Psychologists in the time of fascism were very interested in the observation of behavior and the possibilities of developing psychotherapy as a kind of glue that would more tightly bind together the community as a nation. It's important to remember that psychology is not only a biological reductionist discipline. Psychology aims to regulate the mind as well as the genes. The speakers in this discussion today have each prepared 6 theses that are designed to interrupt the apparatus of psychology. We want to interrupt the process by which the discipline of psychology calls out to each individual subject in such a way that it makes individuals believe and feel that psychology has something to say about them. We want to interrupt the claim that psychology makes to tell the truth about human beings. Psychology does not tell the truth. Psychology tells a political story which carries with it a pathologizing of people who do not fit. So we want to interrupt psychology, and we want you to interrupt us. We will be brief with our 6 theses because we want time for discussion. First of all, critical psychology, practical deconstruction. Psychologists disagree among themselves about what psychology should be. We call this discussion critical psychology, and we know that there are many varieties of critical psychology. The approach that we're taking is a very broad approach, which includes but cannot be reduced to the Kritische Psychologie, which is very powerful in the last 2 decades in Germany. And we disagree among ourselves as to how critical psychology should interrupt mainstream psychology. So let me offer 6 theses as starting points. First, critical psychology is not a positive program for improving or substituting new ideas for old in the discipline, and it does not draw on existing political programs to build an alternative psychology. We do not want to help psychologists reflect on what they do so that they may do it more effectively. We do not want to develop new sub-disciplines of psychology that will allow psychologists to regulate people in new ways. We have no faith in the ability of political programs to tell us what human psychology should be like, because we have learnt that every specification of human psychology is a constraint on the capacity of human beings to change their own psychology as they change society. And we do not want to develop alternative psychologies that promise to tell us the truth, because we know that every claim to truth about human psychology is a political program which is rooted in the limited political horizons of the present day.
Stop. I have a question. That is only negative. What does critical psychology actually do?
Well, critical psychology is the systematic examination of how some varieties of psychological action and experience are privileged over others, how dominant accounts of psychology operate ideologically and in the service of power. We turn the gaze of the psychologist back on the discipline. Psychologists usually study people outside who they treat as the non-psychologists. We study the psychologists. How does evolutionary psychology confirm differences between men and women and make them seem biologically unchangeable? How does psychoanalytic psychology pathologize lesbians and gay men in the name of normal stages of development? How does intelligence testing reinforce the difference between ethnic groups? How does the study of organizations by psychologists make them run more smoothly and better able to destroy dissent?
This is all still too grim. It looks like we can do nothing. What about resistance?
Okay, three. Critical psychology is the study of the ways in which all varieties of psychology are culturally, historically constructed, and how alternative varieties of psychology may confirm or resist ideological assumptions in mainstream models. We assume that where there is power, there is resistance, and that in every dominant practice, there are contradictions and spaces for us to work to challenge and change the existing state of affairs. Mainstream psychology is incoherent, and that incoherence is one of the sources of our strength. A psychological test may be used to rescue a child from a special school, may be used. An attention to the structure of the family may be a lever against biological psychiatric diagnosis. Humanist images of the person contradict experimental studies. But while we look for resistance in these ideas, we do not believe any of them. What is most important in this dialectical activity is to look for political tactics, not underlying truth.
Ian, wait a minute. I think you are only talking about academic psychology. I guess psychology is in many different places.
Okay, four. Critical psychology is also the study of forms of surveillance and self-regulation in everyday life and the ways in which psychological culture operates beyond the boundaries of academic and professional practice. Psychology is not only at work in the universities and the clinics. It is not only the body of men, usually men, armed with instruments for testing and enforcement in the training institutions and the hospitals. We need to study the way in which psychology has recruited thousands upon thousands of academics and professionals who use its ideas and appeal to its theories to back up their own political programs of normalization and pathologization. And we need to study the way in which psychology recruits all of the people, all of us, who read and believe in theories of individual personality differences and happy, healthy behavior. We need to study the way it recruits all of us in psychological culture.
But once again, you make it seem as if there is no space for us to change things if psychology is all around us.
Well, okay, number five. Critical psychology is also the exploration of the way everyday ordinary psychology structures academic and professional work in psychology and how everyday activities might provide the basis for resistance to contemporary disciplinary practices. The discipline of psychology pretends that it is a science, but it draws its images of the human being from politics and from everyday life. And part of the deconstruction of psychology is the study of the way ideology in politics is the condition of possibility for psychology to exist. Psychological theories do not come out of nowhere. They do not fall from the sky. And we can draw upon the variety of different theories about our own psychologies to interrupt and subvert the dominant stories that are told by the academics and the professional psychologists.
But then you haven't said what deconstruction means and how it could help us.
Okay, number six, the final thesis. Critical psychology is the practical deconstruction of every attempt to normalize some kinds of behavior and experience and to pathologize others. Psychology is constructed within the horizons of capitalist society to enable that society to run more efficiently. And it constructs within that society its own images of pathology. Part of the political activity of challenging the construction of psychology is the unraveling of what we have been made to be. The process of critique is also deconstruction. It must include a practical political alliance with all those who suffer psychology and who are starting to refuse the way they have been constructed as pathological. It is a political question that calls for practical deconstruction of the theories and apparatus of the discipline in psychology. Okay, I now want to introduce you to Erica Berman from Manchester in England. And my question to Professor Berman is, why does the idea of development in psychology pathologize people?
And my answer is six theses around challenging development as hierarchy. My first thesis is this. Conceptions of development are usually thought of as being arranged in sequential stages that are presumed to be universal. This is the model that psychology provides, which also pervades our daily lives. It fills our heads with ideas of how we should look after children, what kind of family context it's best to grow up in, and whether being gay or lesbian means you can be a good parent or a bad parent. These developmental narratives may appear culture and value-free, but they are in fact saturated with class, gendered, and cultural assumptions. And what makes them even more important is that they form the body of knowledge that health and welfare services draw upon to determine whether and how to intervene in our lives. Development is seen as restricted to happening within particular temporal limits and under certain conditions. If these conditions are not met, appropriate development is not considered to be possible and may be used to warrant state interventions. Thus, this model elaborates developmental hierarchies of exclusion and privilege.
But what has this to do with psychiatry?
Thesis two. Far from challenging psychiatric systems of classification and pathologization, developmental models fuel and support these. Systems of pathologization require definitions of what is normal to differentiate the normal from the pathological. Moreover, developmental claims work from statistical descriptions of what is the case to generate prescriptions, ideas of what ought to be the case. And these invent normative fictions from generalizations from how people live now. Stories of development, and they are only stories, are used to offer nature stories, stories about what is natural, that make current systems of privilege that are structured around class, race, gender, or sexuality appear natural and inevitable. This is because once something is regarded as natural, it is seen as unchanging and unchangeable. Developmental claims are therefore central to systems of regulation and normalization that underlie models of individual history, family structure and relations, and mental health, as well as notions of progress and maturity.
All this critique is very well, but what does this mean for what we should be doing in practice?
Thesis three. Because models of development privilege the culturally masculine, they position women, black people, and cultural minorities, and even children as culturally deficient and inferior. Their experiences are treated as mere steps on the evolutionary ladder to modern Western developmental maturity. We can challenge this by pointing out the covert ways women and black people and children are considered less rational or more mad than white middle-class men. And on this basis, they are denied rights of representation and consultation because it is assumed that others know better and can act on their behalf. Moreover, we can also expose how constructions of Western masculinity in fact mask the irrational characteristics of detachment, including the hostility and isolation that our dominant culture celebrates as self-sufficiency and autonomy.
But aren't you talking about old colonial evolutionary theories? What about the modern technological world?
Thesis 4. Indeed, models of development privilege modern technological progress as both tool and goal of development. They inscribe definitions of rationality with adaptation to prevailing norms and labor exploitation. The culmination of this, as we all know, was the Nazi genocide of Jews, Romanies, gay men and lesbians, Catholics, political dissidents, and people with diagnoses of mental illness and mental handicap. There are two key things I think we need to do. Firstly, we need to disrupt the equation between development and adaptation. And secondly, we need to challenge the ways models of development homogenize the diversity of forms of development, and so marginalize subordinated, cultural, sexual, and differently abled experiences further. And instead of doing those things, we should encourage celebrations of diverse forms of gendered, cultural, and sexual developments. This strategy will destabilize the instrumental exploitation of our minds and bodies in the name of a soulless idea of progress. And it also helps to ask the question, whose development are we talking about? Who benefits from this and why?
But I thought development was about children. You're talking about everything but childhood.
Yes, it's strange how children figure in our imaginations as the exemplar of development, and yet they disappear from its deep structure. This is because the child that symbolizes individual development is a statistical fiction that does not correspond to any real children's needs or experiences. This methodological sleight of hand, in fact, promotes an abstract asocial representation of development, where development is, in fact, without children, without history, without culture, and without communities. In the name of saving children, we often support the globalization of what is in fact a very Western defined model of economic as well as psychological development. And so we need to be careful, I think, of the ways that children figure within international aid and development campaigns. So although the singular child inhabits the Western imagination as the true authentic self, we need to see how the sentimentality that surrounds how we see children, in fact, blinds us to the very unchildlike conditions of many children's lives and adults' childhood histories.
Okay, but what does unpacking development enable us to do?
This is 6. We need to destabilize monolithic definitions and instead promote diverse models of development. Instead of being subject to normalizing coercive developmental stages, we can put development itself on its own stage to show its many performances. By such means, we will produce multiple ways of viewing and engaging with what development is and is for. Now, this goes beyond exoticizing the experiences of the dispossessed in the form of romanticizing the distress of mental illness or the exploitation of children of the third world. And it goes beyond privileging local over global knowledge. Rather, we should work to promote links of interest and activities between subordinated groups, so that, for example, women's and children's interests, whether we're talking about the mental health systems or around labor issues, these should be understood as neither absolutely competing nor as separable, that is, the relationship between women's and children's interests. And black people and gay men and lesbians can ally together to challenge the ways normative models render their positions inferior and so are used to legitimate their oppression. So, whether individual or social, the traditional story of development is one of dispossession and appropriation rather than emancipation. The lesson of development as hierarchy, as I've described it, is that we need to tread the difficult path between uncritically celebrating traditional forms of culture and contributing to further globalizations or imperialisms. That is, we should support critical alternative traditions, but we should also challenge all orthodoxies to avoid reproducing new ones. This includes perhaps making the user movement or communities so much experts that we leave all the planning and responsibility for service provision to them. And this involves making provisional alliances with different constituencies and with multiple agendas. We are a long way, I think, from reconstructing an emancipatory model of development, but instead, by such means, we may create ways of organizing together that, if we only allow ourselves to see them, will produce new, more helpful ideas of what people are and can be like. And this includes constructing different ideas of psychopathology.
Okay, thank you, Erica. We're going to move on now to Eugenie Yogaka from Thessaloniki in Greece. And my question to Dr. Yogaka is, what is wrong with studying psychotic speech? A quite different question.
I have to say, I'm not sure there is anything inherently wrong about studying psychotic speech. This is something we can discuss later. But I'm certain there is something wrong about the way psychotic speech has been studied and is being studied, mainly by psychiatry and clinical psychology. So I'm going to talk about psychotic speech as an example to show you how clinical practice and research is not neutral, but very actively pathologizes people with specific patterns of speaking in this occasion. So speech disturbances are supposed to be a common symptom and defining feature of psychosis, and especially schizophrenia. In psychiatry, psychotic speech is called thought disorder, and treated as a disorder of the form in which thoughts are expressed. And that's my first thesis. The psychiatric concept of thought disorder is based on the assumption that speech is a direct reflection of disturbances in the speaker's mind or brain. And this presumed transparent relation between thought and speech is unarticulated and unquestioned in psychiatric literature.
But you are jumping ahead of yourself. What is thought disorder?
Well, there's a number of scales which are used by clinicians to diagnose thought disorder. The scales include categories measuring the amount of speech produced, the amount of information provided, the speed of speech, incoherence, repetitions, the way words are used, idiosyncratic reasoning, asocial attitudes, disorganized or confused ideas, introducing personal material in the response, physical behavior, and affective behavior. You can see the variety of categories included in the concept, and it is reasonable to conclude from that, and this is my second thesis, that thought disorder is an umbrella term under which a variety of linguistic, communicational, and behavioral phenomena are included. Now, when these scales, these are diagnostic scales, when the scale is administered, the patient ends up with a total score indicating the degree of thought disorder they're suffering from. And as you can guess, people with the same score of thought disorder can present completely different pictures in terms of their linguistic and communicational strategies.
Hang on, Jenny. Thought disorder is meant to be a deviation from normal speech and thought. How is normal speech defined then?
This is a very interesting point because, surprisingly enough, normality is not the way normal people speak, think, or communicate. To start with, the scales have not been standardized in relation to the normal population. And moreover, when they were administered after they were constructed to normal populations, they found that normals also suffer from mild degrees of thought disorder, especially under conditions of stress and fatigue. So my third thesis is that psychotic speech is constructed in opposition to normal speech, which is not the way normal people speak, whatever that is, but an idea of how people should speak. What this ideal contains is easy to guess by looking at the categories I mentioned before. But what is also problematic is that these assumptions about normal speech are not articulated, and how they were arrived at is not discussed or justified anywhere in the literature. Now, these scales are customarily used as a diagnostic tool, administered by clinicians to diagnose the presence and the degree of thought disorder in patients. However, they were also designed to be used as a research tool, and this proves to be even more problematic. The usual research design on thought disorder is as follows. The research is designed to test some hypotheses about the nature of the underlying deficit that produces thought disorder, that produces strange speech. Groups of thought-disordered schizophrenics, this is the terminology used, non-thought-disordered schizophrenics and normals are administered some experimental task, which is designed to measure this assumed underlying deficit, and then the results of the three groups are compared. And the problem is that the results are usually inconsistent.
Why is that, Jenny?
Well, the clinical phenomena psychiatrists are faced with are, firstly, some schizophrenics suffer from thought disorder and some do not. Secondly, schizophrenics who suffer from thought disorder do so intermittently. And thirdly, the speech disturbances that schizophrenics present are varied and include a variety of linguistic, communicational, and behavioral phenomena. And the question psychiatric research has been struggling to address for the past century is the following. Assuming that schizophrenia is a single disease entity, and therefore caused by one mechanism, how can one mechanism produce speech disturbances differentially and intermittently, and how can one mechanism be responsible for such a variety of speech disturbances? Needless to say, they have not found an adequate answer. And what none of these clinicians and researchers have considered is that, and this is my fourth thesis, thought disorder is a construct produced and perpetuated by diagnostic and research practices. In research on psychotic speech, experimental subjects are assigned to the thought-disordered and non-thought-disordered groups, categories, on the basis of being administered a scale, a thought-disorder scale. So maybe the variability within the thought-disordered group has to do more with a variety of categories included in the scales than with some postulated inherent heterogeneity of thought disorder. And also the fact that some schizophrenics suffer from thought disorder while others don't might be explained by the diagnostic criteria of schizophrenia. Thought disorder is one of the criteria, but not a necessary one. So what is even more sinister is that a vicious cycle exists between diagnosis and research. Thought disorder is defined, and diagnostic tools are developed which measure language, thought, and communication performance. These tools then are used to identify thought-disordered subjects for research projects in which their linguistic performance is assessed. And if these research projects' results are considered significant, they are incorporated back into the diagnostic tools. So my fifth thesis is, through diagnostic and research practices, thought disorder, that is psychotic speech, acquires the status of a fact, of a clinical entity located in the patient, independent of the clinicians and researchers who struggle to understand and treat it.
How can this cycle be broken?
My brief answer is, that's the sixth one, any empowering perspective on psychotic speech would have to expose the unarticulated assumptions that sustain the edifice and, as a result, destabilize the category. And this includes assumptions about the relation between thought and speech, about the nature of clinical disorders, about the neutrality of clinical and research practices, and finally, about the scientific modes of investigation.
If ideally we manage to undermine this pathologizing concept of thought disorder, what can be put in his place?
Good question. Instead of answering it, I will add some more questions. How can we understand the speech peculiarities produced by some individuals diagnosed as psychotic in a non-pathologizing and non-objectifying way? Should we abolish the category of psychotic speech or retain it with a different meaning? I can't even begin to answer these questions, and I certainly don't have the answers. But I'll leave you with these questions for a discussion later.
Okay, thanks, Jenny. And I think people may take up those questions. We've been looking so far at different aspects of psychology. We looked at developmental psychology, and we looked at psychotic speech, the research in clinical psychology on language. But let's stop for a moment and look critically at critical psychology. Our next speaker is Ángel Gordo López from Madrid in Spain. Dr. Gordo López, in this critical discussion of psychology, why are you telling us that there is a problem with critical psychology?
All right, Ian. As Ian mentioned before in his presentation, critical psychology is a group of voices opposed to positivist and experimental psychology. As you know, and I think he also mentioned, critical psychology started to be developed in a critical developing way in the 70s. These people, initially, they thought of critical psychology as a strategy, as a short-term strategy. And psychology itself, even critical psychology, for those people, was part of the problem. And this brings myself straight to the first thesis I want to share with you. And this first thesis can be formulated that there hasn't been a sustained debate on why should any form of critical psychology be any better than a non-critical psychology. And I think the little importance given to this debate was partly due to the fact that early critical psychology was considered, as I said before, as a short-term strategy, not as a sub-discipline, not as a way of doing the right thing. The attempt to institutionalize recently critical psychology also coincides with other processes, other wider processes that I want to indicate now. At the same time that we hear in the academic community more and more about critical psychology, critical journals and publications and critical meetings, we also see that there is an impetus for more action research-oriented critique. That's it. Let's go straight to the action. There is also another trend, that is the promotion of good critical psychological practices and values. There is another process that can underlie this sort of institutionalization of critical psychology, and that is the distinguished role of psychoanalytic and therapeutical theoretical resources. And finally, among some of these processes, there is the possibility, as I'm saying, of conferring critical psychology at subdisciplinary status. And together with these processes, I would like to hold on the way critical psychology is putting forward sort of humanistic and liberated notions of subjectivity. What I mean by liberated notion of subjectivity is a psychologizing way of understanding subjectivity away from institutional and disciplinary conditions.
Hold on, Ángel. It would be unfair to put in the same bag the different forms of psychoanalytic resources and action-oriented research.
Yeah, I agree. There are significant differences among the difference, for example, psychoanalytic theories and trends. I am also aware that psychoanalytic theory helped to recuperate progressive notions of subjectivity in psychology in the past. But I hope we can on agreement on the need to understand these turning points on a broader context than the psychological one, or even the psychiatric one, or even the NACIS one. It is in this broader context where I want to ground the next three theses. The second thesis is that there are serious dangers inherent to the renewed interest of critical psychology in new age forms of cultural diversity, liberated subjectivity, and liberated or liberal humanism. The third one, that we ought to consider the way psychology as psychoanalysis and as psychiatry operates beyond the boundaries of academics and professional practice. And in this regard, the fourth thesis says that confining action research or resistance to psychological and mental health establishments may bolster the dangerous fantasy of replacing politics by critical psychology or by racial tribunals.
Ángel, I see the point of the dangerous fantasy of replacing politics by critical psychology, but I'm not fully convinced on the way critical groups such as psychology, politics, resistance, or the Hearing Voices Network fall within the psychologizing and humanist turn that you mentioned?
You know, Terry, I subscribe to Asylum. It's a critical psychological journal. But I don't think the point here is to demeaning the work of this network or publications, or even stigmatizing current critical psychology or even Russell's tribunals. On the contrary, I suggest to take this turning point seriously as a way of reflecting upon wider processes. Such a reflection, for instance, makes us understand somehow the way there are new relations between biology, psychology, and information society, for instance. And in this way of looking at broader contexts than the psychological or the psychiatric one and those contexts in the academic or professional settings, I would like to bring an example. At night, I normally listen to a Spanish radio program called Talking for Talking. In this program recently, I mean, people call late at night talking about their problems, their worries, and it's the same audience who call giving advices or sharing similar experiences. Recently, there was a person who called saying how much burden she was experiencing, how much trouble she was experiencing in upbringing her child with a Down syndrome. During the next 3 or 4 weeks, there were new callers pathologizing this woman, this mother, almost challenging and putting into question her mothering competence. These people were expressing how this mother could say such a thing, how this mother could express that it was such a burden, it was such a heavy thing, a painful thing to bring, upbring such a child. These callers, instead of pathologizing Down syndrome, they were romanticizing the friendly, emotional, and human side of Down syndrome. But I think that all these new positive views, for example, around Down syndrome, correspond or find relations with other processes. I don't know if you are aware of this best-selling book on emotional intelligence by Daniel Goleman. I don't know if you are aware, for instance, of these children programs with those friendly creatures that they are very, you know, lovable, you know. They are called the Teletubbies. And I don't know if you are also aware of, for instance, the new training teacher programs they run on emotional intelligence courses.
Well, we have courses and ideas about emotional literacy in Britain right now. And I want to ask you, Angel, surely the return of these kind of emotional models, this focus on emotions, is some kind of symptom. It's a symptom of a process rather than a new psychological model in itself. Surely the question here is how to resist such individualizing impulses, and in particular, how to prevent this new form of psychologization fulfilling the same functions of regulation and generalization and homogenization of differences that of the traditional varieties as within child development models.
Yes, Erica, and I would add another question rather than answering that. I will say, what are the processes which allow us to move from experiencing Down, for instance, as a life burden, a genetic untreatable disorder, to romanticizing the emotional and loving nature of these kids? And can we find any correspondence between these dynamics and the playful and emotional nature of what I said before, like the Teletubbies children program? I think it would be interesting to connect these cultural tendencies with the humanist and psychologizing turning points of critical psychology. In other words, I don't think we can separate these cultural representations on the way psychology and critical psychology forge new forms of subjectivity compatible with the neoliberal and post-biological new world order. In this new world order, social problems are still being dissolved in psychological or psychiatric problems as symptoms, which can be related to the first major crisis of the welfare state in the early 70s. But nowadays, these psychologizing forms of managing social matters have acquired new biological and informational inflections.
Yes, it's relevant that there is a return to biological determinism among pro-gay positivist research on things like the gay brain, the gay gene, the female intuition gene, and so on.
And another thing, there's also a tendency to identify the access and use of new interacting information technology with false ideas of democracy. Mainstream psychology is actively engaged in coordinating such fake things. Take, for example, the US journal Cyber Psychology and Behavior, which through the publication of studies on neuropsychological effects of the multimedia, internet addiction, etc., aims to create better relationships between psychologists, psychiatrists, sociologists, educators, computer scientists, business executives, and opinion makers.
Yeah, I think these sort of relations, and especially those relations between information technology, biology, and psychology, have a seductive power over culture, especially when they purpose or they offer us truth, authenticity, the security of identity, and the solution to all sort of personal and collective problems, as Ian Hodge will be telling us later on. And I think it is in this context of these alliances, of these sort of alliances that are emerging now, that I would like to ask, and this is my fifth thesis. In what extent the renewed interest in genetics and biology in culture resonates with those of the liberal democracies? Are critical psychology interests on humanity, therapy, psychoanalysis, new age forms of liberated subjectivity masking the very socioeconomic conditions that render them possible? But there are also some differences to be noticed here between critical psychology and mainstream psychological practices, knowledge, and agencies. While psychological resources permeate all sorts of sociocultural spheres, critical psychology has been increasingly confined to psychological issues and practices in the clinical, educational, and research contexts. That is, while mainstream psychology permeates and acts on all sorts of resources we have available to think about ourselves and act about ourselves and other people, critical psychology, on the other hand, coinciding with its institutionalization in the academic life, has lost sight of wider and most dispersed arena of culture. And that will be the final thesis. I would like to leave you with it. We then face here the strategic issue of whether to articulate critical research inside institutionalized psychological, psychiatric, psychotherapeutic, educational settings, and or in the most dispersed, changeable, and shifting arenas of psychological culture, a term that designates the way psychology operates beyond the boundaries of academics and professional practice.
Okay, thanks, Angel. We always need to keep in mind that there are problems with the critical approaches that we use. Now we want to move on to something else that is important to our work. Ian Hodges is from London in England as the next speaker. And my question to Dr. Hodges is, why is research into the gay gene, which is so prolific and so around us in the press at the moment, why is research into the gay gene relevant to psychology and to critical psychology?
Okay, thanks. I'd like to leave that question in some sense until the discussion, and my six theses are somewhat kind of spread through what I'm going to say. The pathologization of lesbian and gay sexuality that's taken place from the latter part of the 19th century has never simply been a matter of constituting it as some form of physiological or psychological disorder, but has fundamentally occurred through various historically changing forms of problematization which have claimed to know the truth about homosexual desire. Most recently, debates over its alleged biological origins have risen to the fore, so that causality has become central to the current problematization. I'll begin today by very briefly considering some problems with the genetic research, and then move on to consider what I believe is fundamentally at stake here, That is, not only our conception of sexual identity and its place in the moral order, but also the ways in which this kind of research renders the structural, political, and psychological aspects of oppression invisible. Research projects focusing on the links between genes and homosexuality have included heritability and so-called linkage studies. For example, Dean Hamer claimed to have identified a possible link between a gene marker on the X chromosome and homosexuality. Critics, however, point to the significant difference between heritability and inheritance. The key issue here is the difference between direct inheritance of something like eye color, which is fixed, and the association of heritable factors with complex human behaviors, which will always be multiply determined. What is interesting about this kind of research is the way in which its findings have been reported in the media, as if they showed inheritance rather than heritability, and of course relying on this term gay gene. This argument also applies to a range of other reported links, for example, claims of a gene marker linked to schizophrenia.
Okay, Ian. But what about the social and political aspects of this debate?
For some critics, any research which aims to discover the causes of homosexuality is in some sense homophobic. Whether or not one takes this view, it is difficult to believe that such research operates from a position of disinterested science. In fact, many of the scientists involved with this kind of work take very public stands on the issue. For example, Dean Hamer and Simon LaVey have always given a high public profile to their beliefs that homosexuality is biologically determined, adopting Randy Schilt's often quoted aspiration that homosexuality will eventually be considered as a natural human variation, just like left-handedness. Yet researchers like Hamer and LaVey wish us to believe that the conduct of their research is value-free, that is, proper science. However, as with all hypothetico-deductive research, the sources of the speculation from which one generates hypotheses are not of interest. It may be argued, though, that this is precisely what we should be studying. Why is it that it makes more sense to ask about the causes of homosexuality rather than heterosexuality? And most importantly, what are the conditions of possibility for asking these questions? A key issue here is that all these perspectives, which mobilize biological determinism as the core of their political strategies, assume homosexuality or sexual orientation to be a unitary, fixed, bounded, and singular entity. However, categories of social identity have complex histories and manifold relations to the social, cultural, political, and economic conditions within which they arise. Rather than being fixed and bounded, these categories are dispersed and fragmented. At the psychological level, the thoughts, feelings, beliefs, and so on that are contained within this term sexual orientation are many and complex. Eve Sedgwick talks about the way in which the notion of homosexuality requires many different aspects of sexuality all to line up. For homosexuality to be a unitary, fixed, stable entity, she argues, biological sex, self-perceived gender assignment, preponderance of masculinity and femininity, self-perception as gay or straight, our sexual fantasies, the main locus of our emotional bonds, and our preferred sexual acts must all point in one single direction. Yet for many individuals, it is likely that there will be great variation within these different aspects of sexuality. Thus, homosexuality, or sexual preference, is far from a single unitary and fixed kind. However, all research within this area, which seeks to find a cause, assumes this to be the case. Despite these conceptual problems with this search for a gay gene, A genetic account of homosexual desire is sought after by many lesbians and gay men, though to a lesser extent among lesbians, reminding us that these claims to the truth about desire have important consequences for individual conduct. One might ask, in relation to this current problematization of homosexual desire, which is very much about causes and biology, in what ways are lesbians and gay men, and also bisexual and transgender persons, enjoined, invited, to think about themselves as certain kinds of people, with certain kinds of psychological qualities, and accordingly to regulate their behavior in certain kinds of ways? These debates about causality are not only about morality, but they're also about ethics. Foucault famously told us, sexuality gives power access to the body. What kind of power effects, then, would we see with a genetic understanding of sexual identity? Would a non-essentialist sexual identity allow more scope for inventing new ways of relating to each other, new forms of sexuality, as Foucault himself has suggested? He said in 1989, "To be gay, I think, is not to identify with the psychological traits and the visible masks of the homosexual, but to try to define and develop a way of life. Homosexuality is an historic occasion to reopen affective and relational virtualities, not so much through the intrinsic qualities of the homosexual, but due to the biases against the position he occupies." Perhaps the most serious consequence of this focus upon causes, whether biological or otherwise, is that these debates render invisible key structural and political processes which many have diagnosed as fundamental to understanding the oppression of lesbians and gay men. Above all, it is the norm of compulsory heterosexuality that pervades this research. In moving closer to a cry of victimhood and pleas for normality, In moving closer to a cry of victimhood, the pleas for normality found in biologically determinist arguments do little to change this. What is really at stake here is the policing of the boundaries of heterosexuality. Gay gene studies, by suggesting that a small minority of individuals have atypical genes, which simply render them different to the norm, serve only to further authorize those boundaries. And those who argue for complexity and or choice go much further in disrupting them.
Okay, thanks, Ian. We're moving now to the final speaker in this discussion before we open the discussion to the audience. And the next speaker, the final speaker, is Terence McLaughlin from Asylum in England. Dr. McLaughlin, are you really telling us, as you told me earlier, that psychology is war?
Thesis one. Psychology is war, and the main point of war is to inflict the maximum psychological damage on a population. And do you ask me if I'm really saying that psychology is war? Do you have a problem with that? Does it remind you that the history of modern societies is the history of class war?
You mean Marxism?
Yes. Is it something in the language? Is there no connection between the classifications in psychology and the classifications of political economy? Are we supposed to believe that Marx was wrong? Because even the bourgeois economists are not so sure about that. Remember Karl Popper? Well, he had a problem with Freud because he could not falsify him. But Marx predicted that capitalism would lead to the impoverishment of the masses. The likes of Popper and Hans Eysenck looked around the Western world and said, well, that can't be true. Well, I look around at the effects of globalization and see that Marx was right. And another thing, war is not about the destruction of private property. The point is, it is the people who are hurting. It is not the loss of their private property. It is their sense of alienation from the products of their labor.
But Terence, you're not saying
that psychologists are at the center of the military, are you?
Post-war trauma is the site for psychological imperialism. Maybe we should say psychologists are waiting in the wings. But we both know that the military are very interested in psychology, and particularly the kind of qualitative research that many of us as critical psychologists seem to do. Don't they come along to the universities and ask us to teach them the method? All these new paradigm approaches which claim to privilege people's stories over experimental results. In fact, these days, military intelligence is less interested in traditional hard science, positivist analysis of variables, opinion polls, and statistics. They want to know what the masses are really thinking and feeling, how their subjects are really constructed. And this is only one step away from moving in with therapies for both post-traumatic stress disorder. This is what I saw personally working for the World Health Organization in Kosovo.
So what is a critical psychologist doing wearing the badge of the United Nations in the Balkans?
That's actually a very good question. Maybe I was just earning a living and maybe I was kidding myself that a critical approach could do service not only to the suffering of the people, but equally to their dignity and their right to self-determination, no better or worse than a war correspondent. Okay, so I was teaching community mental health to family doctors as part of their training in clinical psychiatry. At best, I was a social psychological guerrilla resisting the might of the international drugs companies.
Terence, I know you mean well, but you know as well as me that community health is the watchword of both the World Health Organization and the World Bank. So, where is the critical?
Community psychology is the site of exclusion. But the first thing is that it's not about purism and keeping out of war zones. Critical psychologists do mean well, and so do, I believe, that minority of critical psychiatrists. But you are right, the danger is that by attaching criticality to community, radical action is open to reassimilation by the mainstream and thus strengthening the powers of regulation. The point again is to be able to point the finger at psychology. I'll give you an example from the research of the International Network of People Who Hear Voices. Remember, in pathological language, we are talking about auditory hallucinations. This is experience. In fact, it should never have been taken seriously as a symptom of mental illness. It was psychology which likes to pick out minorities with its bell curves of human distribution, which can be held responsible for the selection of voice hearers for special treatment. It was psychology going back to that great but very confused voice hearer, René Descartes, which created the exclusion. Psychiatry, in fact, has merely socially controlled the recipients of this exclusion arranged by psychology.
So difference is psychogenic rather than somatogenic. What's the difference?
Yes, this question has been played out for over 100 years in schizophrenia research. Cartesian dualism opened the door to mental pathology. And let's not forget how Descartes himself predicted a final solution in medical science. But simply ditching the dualism is not a solution either. The new alliances of holistic practitioners, new ages, and postmoderns, perhaps in coalition with the ancient cultures, all this is a precursor to an even grander international civil war between proponents of biology and proponents of the spirit. And don't forget, the tools of war are demonization and pathologization. To go back to the Hearing Voices movement, this was not about an academic deconstruction of sign language, But it was a practical deconstruction, as Ian spoke about earlier. It was about building a mass movement, like the lobbying by gay activists of the American Psychiatric Association removed homosexuality from the diagnostic manuals. The Hearing Voices Network threatens to put another nail in the coffin of pathologizing. More recently, the celebratory movement of gayness, Gay Pride, has now also set a model for a growing international Mad Pride movement. And there's not much traditional psychology there.
So if critical psychologists don't do psychology, what do they do?
Advocacy, I suggest. Critical psychology as advocacy. Psychology against the law. I want to finish on schizophrenia, the example par excellence of pathologizing and the industry which keeps the drug company's world going round. They will search for the schizophrenia gene until, as they say in England, until the cows come home, which they invariably do these days as mad cows, who then pass on their deadly prions to humans who, for all intents and purposes, develop the symptoms of schizophrenia. This time, some scientific psychologists continue to demonstrate that the psychopathological syndrome of schizophrenia does not exist. But this is no longer the issue for critical psychologists. Schizophrenia does exist as the most treacherous of words. Its diagnosis represents the most barbaric attack on human rights and liberty, and it should be banned. The diagnosis of schizophrenia is a crime, and it should be treated as such. It's perpetrated on such a scale that it's a war crime.
So, this symposium on critical psychology, the psychiatric pathologizing as a political question, brings together different perspectives on the way that critical academics and activists in psychology may oppose the oppressive practices of psychiatry without ratifying oppressive practices in psychology. The participants in this panel share the goal of linking academic critique with activity against the apparatus of the psi complex. The psi complex is an apparatus which sometimes proceeds by direct coercion, usually in the case of psychiatry, but which sometimes proceeds by using indirect means to normalize behavior and experience, which is usually the case in psychology. To oppose Geist to Gayness has to take care not to reinforce harmful practices within the realm of Geist. To most effectively struggle against the psychiatrization of people's lives, we have to take care not to reinforce harmful practices within psychology or even critical psychology. Now, what do you have to say about these arguments?